Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did police officers start to look and act so much like soldiers? Over the past several decades, law enforcement agencies in cities, both large and small, have come to include special weapons and tactics squads, also known as SWAT teams, who are equipped to respond to extreme and violent emergencies, but often are deployed to deal with more mundane crimes. So, what sort of training guides their use of heavy weapons and brute force, and how are they held accountable if they put innocent civilians at risk? Bradley Balco is a senior writer and investigative reporter for the Huffington Post. His new book is called Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Bradley, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on. My pleasure.
So how did Americans defend themselves against crime before the establishment of what we could recognize today as true police departments?
I guess in the colonial days anyway, crime was largely enforced privately. There were, social mores and social pressure, shunning tended to keep people in line. But that was when we lived in communities where everyone was very similar. They worshipped in the same churches and, were of the same ethnic background. There were sheriffs, there were constables, there were marshals, but they were largely administrative. They weren't, they didn't enforce laws as we enforce them today. In fact, police was used mostly as a verb, not as a noun. Hmm. It wasn't really until the 19th century when we started becoming more ethnically diverse and there was some urbanization going on that, I think it was Boston and Philadelphia and New York started establishing what we now know as a sort of centralized organized police department.
And of course, given our history, we had reason to be wary of anything that reminded us of the abuses committed by colonial British troops.
Right. The country was founded on a couple of principles related to this issue. One of them was the Fourth Amendment and this idea of privacy. With that is the Castle Doctrine, which is the concept that the home should be a place of peace and sanctuary, and that the king should not be able to violently enter your home except under the most extreme circumstances. And so, when the British troops were stationed in Boston, they were enforcing the import laws and the tax laws, and they had these general warrants, which let them basically just go into any house they wanted and break in and sort of sort through people's property looking for contraband. And, the abuses got bad enough that, they turned violent. Eventually, this all culminated in the Boston Massacre and, eventually the American Revolution. And so when the, our founders were setting up the country and putting the Constitution together, the images of these troops in Boston, patrolling the streets were fresh in their mind. And so there was you have the Fourth Amendment. We also have the Third Amendment, which isn't talked about all that often, but the prohibition on quartering of troops, except in wartime and with an act of Congress, it isn't talked about very often. But I think the Third Amendment is sort of a placeholder for a broader kind of aversion to militarism in general, that the founders didn't like standing armies. They did establish one, but only reluctantly and with a lot of safeguards in place. I think the founders would look at police as they exist today as a standing army, and I think they would be pretty wary of what powers we give to them. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't have police today, but it does mean that, the idea is not necessarily consistent with some of the founding principles, and so we should be very careful about what sort of powers we give to police.
Yeah, I think the Third Amendment discussion is so interesting here because you're right. People say, well, that doesn't happen anymore. The army is not going to try and take over my house in East Dallas or whatever. But there is a sense that it means much more than that. And in fact, that standard, that broader standard has been, until recent decades, upheld over the years.
Right. I mean, in the U.S., we've done a good job of keeping the military out of domestic policing. There's been some exceptions. Reconstruction after Civil War was one example where, it was necessary. And then there have been a few occasions where the military has been called in to put down, insurrections and riots. But we've never really, we haven't had the military do day-to-day sort of routine law enforcement. There was a time in the 80s when, the Reagan administration and some congressional leaders actually wanted to start bringing active duty soldiers in to conduct drug raids and, you know, arrest suspected drug dealers. Unfortunately, that idea was defeated, and it was defeated mostly because the military was opposed to the idea. As an institution, the military, you know, respects this principle of keeping the soldiers out of the streets and out of domestic law enforcement better than the politicians, really. And so we've done it. We've done a good job of this. And you know, the idea is that soldiers have a very specific mission. I mean, their job is to annihilate a foreign enemy. A police officer's job is to keep the peace and to protect our rights. And it's sort of revealing and unfortunate that I think a lot of politicians think the jobs are similar because they both carry guns and use force, but they really couldn't be more different.
And police officers, excuse me for interrupting, didn't necessarily even used to, as a matter of course, carry deadly force with them. Is that right?
The very earliest police departments, yeah, were unarmed, although that changed pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. But the first police department in London, I mean, the bobbies in London have been unarmed for a long, long, long time. I think some of them are armed today, but, for well into the 20th century, the bobbies in London were unarmed. They had clubs. They didn't have guns. Mm-hmm. But the argument I make in the book is that, you know, while we've respected this tradition of keeping the military out of law enforcement directly, like we don't have soldiers directly enforcing the laws, we've kind of dropped the ball on what you might call indirect militarization, which is that we've allowed and actually encouraged our police officers to look and be armed like and act like soldiers. And, you know, the effect, I think, is very similar, unfortunately.
So let's talk about the 1960s. The late 60s were a time when a lot of Americans felt at risk from a host of seemingly new threats. There was violent street crime, there were race riots, there was drug crime. Talk about how our fears of victimization at that point in our history gave way to a new kind of policing.
Sure. Yeah. So in the 60s, there was all this civil unrest going on, and you know, a lot of it was televised. So, you know, even the parts of America that weren't touched by this were watching it on their TVs every night, and there was a lot of fear. And you know, some of it was justified. I mean, the crime rate did go up dramatically in the late 60s, and it gave cause to a politician like Richard Nixon to come along and really kind of play to those fears. In the 1968 campaign for the White House. And so there were kind of two things going on here in the late 60s and early 70s, two trends that moved parallel for a long time. One of them was the development of the SWAT team. And this happened in Los Angeles when Daryl Gates, who at the time was an inspector at LAPD, he was in charge of LAPD's reaction or response, I guess, to the Watts riots. And, you know, there hadn't really been any riots like Watts in the U.S. When there were riots, they tended to be, you know, an isolated group in an isolated part of the city that you could sort of, you know, corner and keep there until the riots died down. The Watts riots sprung up sort of everywhere, and they would flare up in one part of the city and then flare up in the other. And the rioters were, you know, they were specifically targeting firemen and police officers. And Gates, you know, thought it was likened it to urban warfare, and he thought that LAPD just did not have a proper response to these kinds of situations, and that these kinds of situations were going to continue. So he got this idea of putting together this elite police team, basically trained like soldiers were, where each officer would have a specialty, whether it was, you know, anti-sniper strategies or crowd control or breaching doorways. They would each be specially trained in this, and they would have this sort of elite reaction. And it would be a way, basically it was a way of using violence to diffuse already violent situations. And so the SWAT team became enormously popular. It sort of was infused into the pop culture in the 70s and, you know, spread all over the country. At the same time, then you have Nixon declaring war on drugs and really kind of playing to fears of crime and passing laws like the no-knock raid, which interestingly was the idea of a 29-year-old Senate staffer. This wasn't a policy that police chiefs were asking for or criminologists were saying was necessary. It was basically a campaign issue. This campaign aide came up with the idea of, you know, well, we should let police officers just sort of storm into houses if they suspect there's drug activity going on. And Congress ended up passing it, and we had these, you know, now we had federal narcotics officers, you know, bursting into homes, often without warrants. And so these two trends sort of move parallel throughout the 70s. You have the SWAT team, which are mostly responding to these emergency type situations where there's an immediate threat. And then you have the drug war moving along also. And then it's really in the 80s that the two trends start to converge.
So initially, as these SWAT teams spread around the country and were trained, their use was reserved for the most dire of situations, where I think most reasonable people would agree that it makes sense for police to go in heavily armed. How did that begin to change over time?
Well, it really began to change in the 80s when the Reagan administration, you know, really tried to make the drug war metaphor very literal. You know, they brought the National Guard in to start doing anti-drug operations. As I mentioned before, they wanted to bring active duty troops in to enforce the drug laws. And they really started, they sent up these joint task forces across the country, which were basically a way of for the military to work directly with local police agencies on drug interdiction efforts. And this included training police officers on military tactics. And so, you know, we start to see then this increased cooperation between local police and the military. We start to see local police start adopting some of these military tactics. And then Reagan does a couple of other things. First, he starts these federal anti-drug grants that go to police departments. And, you know, these grants only go for drug policing. You know, if you arrest a murderer or a rapist, you don't get any money from the federal government. If you arrest, you know, a drug user, there's federal money tied to that. And so that really encouraged police to start devoting more personnel and resources to enforcing the drug laws. And then Reagan started making surplus military gear from the Pentagon available to local police departments to use. And so this was, you know, this is equipment that was designed for use on a battlefield that was being given to local police departments and has ever since, actually, for use on, you know, American streets and in American neighborhoods. And so you have all this gear sort of coming to your department, right? And then you have this cooperation going on with the military, and then you have these, you know, federal grants that are directly tied to drug policing. And so what we start to see then is the formation of these SWAT teams and this very strong federal incentive to use them to enforce the drug laws, because there's all this money tied to using them for that purpose.
I want to underscore something you said a moment ago, which is you said you get more money if you arrest a drug user as compared with, you know, some other kind of criminal. You said user, not dealer.
I should have said offender, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, in either case, I mean, a drug arrest is a drug arrest. And that's actually a common misconception about how these grants work. You know, if you watch a crime procedural on television, you know, they do the thing where they arrest the low-level guy and they, you know, cut a bargain with him, and he gives up all the guys above him, and they sort of climb the ladder that way. The way the federal incentives are structured, and this is Ed Burns, the co-creator of The Wire, the HBO show The Wire, who's a former narcotics cop, has talked a lot about this. The way the federal structures are set up, there's an incentive for police departments actually to get somebody sort of in the middle and cut a deal with them to give up everybody underneath them, because there are so many more, you know, it's structured like a, you know, a Christmas tree, basically. So there's so many people underneath them, that, and you can make more arrests that way. And when it comes to applying for these grants, you know, whether you arrest the kingpin or, you know, the 12-year-old hopper on the street, it's still a one in terms of the statistics.
Investigative reporter Radley Balco is with us. He writes for Huffington Post, and he's the author of a new book called Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. We'll be taking your calls and emails after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Radley Balko. He is an investigative reporter for the Huffington Post and author of the new book Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. You can join us by emailing think at kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Radley, talk about how the training for SWAT officers is different than for detectives or patrol officers or people who provide a number of other functions for municipal police departments.
Well, the training really varies from department to department. In a place like Los Angeles, they have a very professional SWAT team. It's elite. They're choosing the best officers from a huge police department. They're full time. They get lots and lots of training. I would still argue that they're used too often, but it is a very, professional team that, takes their work very seriously. As you get into some of the smaller departments, however, the SWAT teams start to become part-time, and the officers don't get nearly that much training. And in some cases, you get some of these regional task forces that are just kind of thrown together, again, with federal funding, actually. And they're much less professional. I think they're probably overused too, but it's even, worse when they're overused because they're not, nearly as well trained as the, the better funded SWAT teams in the bigger cities.
And the thought being well trained, one of the advantages there is that you're less likely to make mistakes to involve innocent people.
Right. I mean, these raids are, these SWAT raids are highly volatile raids. I mean, they're violent. They're breaking into homes in the middle of the night, and when you do that, you elicit a very primal response in people, whether it's a drug dealer or an innocent family who you raided by mistake, the first instinct for a lot of people is going to be to defend themselves and their families, and so there's a very little margin for error in these raids, and so that's why the more professional SWAT teams take them so seriously, because they want to get in and clear a house or a structure as quickly as possible before someone has, a chance to arm themselves. And, that's really why I think it's wrong and unnecessary to be using these kinds of tactics on people who don't present an immediate threat to the public, because they are so volatile and they are so confrontational and they are so, there's such a small margin for error that, a mistake on either side, misidentification by the person being raided or mistakes by SWAT members, can very easily and has lead to, tragic outcomes.
Who pays for the consequences of those mistakes, whether it's injury to an innocent person or someone who is not ultimately convicted of a crime, or it is property damage even?
No one really. I mean, even when they get the wrong house, in some places they'll pay for damage they've done. A lot of places they don't. The shooting the dog is common in these raids. In some places it's sort of perfunctory. It's a way to, because the dog can get in the way of what they need to do. There's very rarely any compensation for that, even when it's the wrong house. It's also very difficult to sue a police officer. So, just negligence isn't enough. You have to show malice, that the officer actually intended to violate your rights. So it's very difficult to get in court for these. In terms of officers who make mistakes on raids, there can be disciplinary measures, but it's pretty rare. One of the things I found in researching this book is that there's a real double standard here. If you are wrongly raided and you attempt to defend yourself and shoot at one of the police officers thinking they're criminal intruders, first you're going to be lucky to survive the next few seconds, but if you do, you're almost always going to be charged with some sort of felony, probably attempted murder. When police officers make mistakes on these raids, they're afforded a lot of consideration. I mean, for the circumstances are volatile. They're given the reasonable person standard. Would a reasonable police officer in this position could he have made the same mistake? And so there's very rarely, almost never criminal charges, and very rarely even any professional discipline. And, that double standard, when you consider that the cops know what's happening, mm-hmm. so they have that advantage, and that they're trained, and that, these raids, by design, are meant to surprise people and take them off guard and, you know, kind of confuse them. They deploy these flash grenades, which temporarily blind and deafen you. And so, you know, they when officers are defending these tactics, they'll say they're necessary. You know, it's necessary to take people off guard and by surprise and to confuse them in order, you know, for us to execute this warrant safely. But then they say at the same time, if somebody, you know, mistakes the officers for intruders and shoots at them, they say, well, you know, they should have known that we were police officers. And you know, those two things don't exist comfortably side by side.
So when a police officer discharges a weapon, uses deadly force, even if it turns out not to be deadly and there is no one injured, there's an automatic investigation triggered, but that's done by internal affairs of most police departments. Is that right?
Yeah, it's almost always done by other police officers. I mean, occasionally maybe a prosecutor will do an investigation in a high-profile situation, but most of the time the investigation is conducted by other police officers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Chris in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Hey, Mr. Balco. I've been a fan of your blog for years now. I just had a question about funding for these departments. I know you'd already mentioned federal grant incentives for drug busts, but my question is more specifically regarding asset forfeiture and whether there's really any evidence that it supports a sort of vicious circle. That is, police seize funds during a raid. They use those funds to purchase more equipment, to use on more raids, to seize more funds, and so on.
I think asset forfeiture is a big driving force behind this kind of explosion in the use of SWAT teams. I don't know that you can, you know, money and budgets tend to be sort of fungible, so I don't know that you could directly say that this money went to buy, you know, more equipment. But certainly, I mean, you know, civil asset forfeiture is, I'll just explain it to listeners very quickly. It's this idea that property can be guilty of a crime. And so if the police are in a drug raid in your house and they find drugs, and they, you know, can even sort of loosely connect the drugs to your property, whether it's cash or your house or your car, they can, under asset forfeiture laws, they can seize the property, and basically then you have to go to court and prove that you earned the property legitimately in order to get it back. And in most parts of the country, the money that police officers make off these seizures goes right back to the police department. And with civil forfeiture also, you never even have to be charged with a crime. In fact, most people aren't. It's a troubling practice just, you know, on its own. But then when you throw in the perverse incentive problem where the police officers actually, you know, the department benefits from this policy by being able to keep the proceeds, it gets a lot worse. And so, you know, again, so we get to this point where, again, if you're a police department and you're, you know, on a short budget or things are getting tight, you can keep your SWAT team in reserve for those emergency types of situations where, you know, it's really, really necessary, or you can send them out on drug raids, which not only, you know, have these federal grants tied to them, but then also carry the potential of asset forfeiture, bringing more revenue back to the police department.
Okay, so Bradley, I think a lot of us can imagine certain situations in which we would think the use of a SWAT team might be appropriate. Mm-hmm. But what you found is that the use of these teams in, you know, certain parts of the country, this is almost a daily event. Can you talk about what the incentives are beyond just getting money? I guess once you've spent the money to get all this equipment, you've trained people, is it like a use it or lose it mentality?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's the old, you know, when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail situation. And I mean, you know, the increase in use of these sorts of tactics, I mean, it's mind blowing. There's a criminologist at Eastern Kentucky who has been surveying police departments on their use of SWAT teams, and he found that, you know, in the late 1970s, there were about a few hundred SWAT raids per year in the entire country. By the early 80s, it was around 3,000 per year, and by 2005, when he stopped doing the survey, it was up to 50,000 raids per year, and the vast majority of those are to serve warrants on people suspected of drug crimes. So, you know, we go from a few hundred raids per year in the 70s to, you know, 50,000 per year in 2005. I mean, that is massive. I mean, that is a very, very significant increase in the use of these tactics, which, again, are are very violent and confrontational.
Well, it's interesting that we're having this discussion today because there's news out of a suburb around here this morning that an officer who was serving a warrant at a home, not on a drug crime, but apparently near where a young girl was murdered, was shot today. I mean, people will say, look, you never know when serving a warrant is truly dangerous. How can police departments sort of craft policies that guide them to make appropriate decisions so that officers are protected, but also so that, you know, regular people are not in danger?
Well, I mean, there are always going to be risks, right? I mean, there are risks that come with just being a police officer. And in fact, a very common way that police officers are killed on the job is during traffic stops, where, you know, people, for obviously crazy sick people, will just shoot an officer after they've been pulled over. The way to respond to that is not to have SWAT teams making traffic stops. We obviously want to protect officer safety as best we can, but also, you know, not at the expense of, you know, civil liberties and you know, the principles of a free society. And, you know, I would just argue that, you know, some of the things that SWAT teams are being used today, you know, maybe in on the margins they do make those officers somewhat safer, but, you know, you can't protect them from everything. And, I mean, you know, today I've reported on situations where SWAT teams were sent into bars where they suspected there was underage drinking going on, you know, breaking up neighborhood poker games. In Orlando a couple years ago, they were sending SWAT teams into barbershops to do license inspections to make sure they were licensed by the state to be cutting hair. There's a point where, there's not even an argument anymore, and it's getting fairly ridiculous. One point I make in the book is, you know, in the mid-90s, we really start to see a shift in how these tactics are used. When California legalized medical marijuana and a couple other states followed suit, the federal government responded by sending these federal SWAT teams into these medical marijuana clinics and dispensaries. Now, you know, these were businesses. They were openly operating. They had business licenses. They were, you know, operating under state law. But because they were flouting federal law, the federal government was raiding them with these SWAT teams. Now, that's not, you know, you're not doing that to protect the officer's safety. I mean, the mom-and-pop hippie running the pot dispensary aren't, you know, a threat to kill a bunch of police officers.
Right, right.
This is about sending a message and about, you know, making an example of people. And, you know, government using violence to make an example of people is not, you know, something we normally associate with a free society.
So talk about this. I imagine there are people out there listening saying, well, I'm hearing you say that there are 50,000 SWAT raids a year. I'm not seeing this in my neighborhood. As you discovered, Radley, it really depends on what neighborhood you live in.
Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, like the drug war more generally, I mean, there's a disproportionate use of these kinds of tactics in, you know, poor minority communities. They certainly get the brunt of it. Although, you know, as I mentioned, you know, it's moving into the suburbs. A few years ago in Maryland, a SWAT team actually raided the mayor of a town mistakenly, shot his dogs, and, you know, it was a national story for a while. But we're seeing that. I mean, I think as we see these tactics being used for, you know, increasingly petty offenses, you know, it's going to start moving out of those communities. And of course, it's, you know, awful that it takes that for people to start getting interested and concerned about the issue. But I think that is why we're seeing more of a discussion of these issues in the last few years.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Colette on the line in Dallas. Hi, Colette.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. Go right ahead, please.
Okay. My question was, in your research that you've done, how often or what percentage would you say policemen are indicted when they murder an unarmed or an innocent citizen?
I mean, it's really rare, almost never, actually. I mean, there are a few cases where, you know, if you have a really high-profile case and the media's been covering it closely, a prosecutor might feel some pressure to bring charges. But, you know, juries also don't like to convict police officers. I mean, it's pretty rare. And I should add here that, I mean, my criticism in this book is of the policies that give rise to these raids. I mean, I don't think the individual officers who shoot someone, even an unarmed person in this raid, these raids, I don't think they're, you know, setting out to kill unarmed people. I think they're making human mistakes in very, you know, volatile, tough situations. My criticism is that the policies that created those situations, you know, in the first place, and I think that's really where we need to focus the discussion.
How do you think that disproportionate use of force by police departments affects their relationships with the people they're supposed to be serving?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I it's pretty negatively. I mean, I talk about in the book how, you know, police officers used to walk beats, and now they, you know, they cruise in patrol cars, and the only time they really get out of their cars is when there's a problem, right? So, I mean, you know, if you can imagine having a job where your only interaction with other people is negative, you know, every interaction with other people is going to be negative, that's bad for cops. I mean, that makes your job pretty miserable. But it also creates a lot of tension with the community because the only time they see you is when something's wrong. And so you combine that then with the, you know, the frequent SWAT raids that, you know, can instill in people kind of a feeling that they're being occupied by an outside force. And you get, you know, very strained, tense relations between police and the communities that they serve.
Radley Balko is with us. He's an investigative reporter and senior writer for The Huffington Post. His new book is called Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with investigative reporter Radley Balko. He's a senior writer for the Huffington Post and author of the new book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Radley, I have to ask this. You know, you talk about the use of the deployment of certain SWAT teams in cases where it would appear that the idea is to send a message to act as a deterrent to others that might want to break the law. On the other hand, we have seen over the past several decades a marked drop in crime rates in this country, violent crime in particular. Is it reasonable to ask whether SWAT units have had some beneficial impact on the safety of Americans?
I mean, it's certainly sensible to ask, but there isn't a whole lot of evidence that that's the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, most of these SWAT raids, as I mentioned, are on people suspected of nonviolent, you know, consensual drug crimes. And, you know, drug use has basically just remained constant over the last 40 years or so. I mean, it goes up and down periodically, but the baseline stays pretty much the same.
Yeah.
So it's not really affecting the area where they're, you know, concentrating these raids. Now, I will say there have been a couple instances, you know, in Fresno in the 90s, you know, there was a crime wave going on, and the police department actually deployed a SWAT team to patrol, basically. I mean, it was they were out on patrol. They were, you know, jumping out on people. They were checking IDs. And it really was, you know, an occupation. And, you know, I think the term police state is way overused. But in this case, you know, Fresno was, or portions of Fresno really were sort of like a police state. And it did have an effect on crime. I mean, they basically ended the crime wave by doing that. You know, the question is, you know, is that the appropriate balance? And, of course, that's also not a policy you can implement nationwide. Hmm. So when it's been done in a concentrated area like that, it has had an effect. But I don't think there's, from what I've, you know, the data that I've read, there's no, you know, there's no convincing argument that it's had an effect on crime nationwide.
Your subtitle is The Militarization of America's Police Forces. How do the activities of urban SWAT teams compare with actual U.S. troops who are, say, performing counterinsurgency functions in urban war zones?
You know, that's an interesting question, because when I've been writing on this issue for a while, and I've actually gotten some feedback from people in the military who both conducted raids on, you know, places in Afghanistan and Iraq where there were suspected insurgents, and actually trained raid teams. And they've told me that they actually give more consideration to the people they're raiding overseas than what they see in some of these drug raids, that they don't go in, you know, without knocking or announcing themselves first. They actually surround the place and, you know, get on a megaphone and tell the people to come out and not to surround it. Now, you know, those may be, I have no idea if that's standard practice throughout the military or if it was just from those, you know, people who happened to reach out to me. But I've even, I mean, I gave a talk on this issue at a school about 3 months ago, and one of the faculty members in the school was in the military, and as was his son, and he was actually offended by the word militarization. He said, you know, he agreed with my general sort of perspective on this issue, and that was troubling, but he did not like these tactics being associated with the military. So again, that's, you know, that's one person, but you can, I guess, take that for what it's worth.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak with Rick. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Rick. That's Rick in Fort Worth.
Hi. Yeah, go right ahead.
A couple of questions. I'm concerned about why an officer that is killed in the line of duty chasing a criminal is considered a superhero. He's doing his job he was hired to do. Now, if he steps in front of a bullet, you know, and keeps a kid from getting killed, that's a hero. Hmm. But if he's chasing a criminal and he gets shot and dies, he's not a hero. The other part of my question is, why is it so necessary for every police entity within 150 miles to send a cruiser and cops to his funeral?
Well, I don't know if those are things you want to get into, Radley. What do you think?
Well, I'll talk about something that I think is sort of related to the point the caller is making. I think we do tend to venerate police officers, and in some cases, I think deservedly so. I mean, there are brave cops who have died in the line of duty, and I think they should be honored. But, you know, by the same token, we also are constantly telling police officers how dangerous their job is, and that every interaction with a citizen could be their last. And it really, you know, if you're told that often enough, it can instill in you a very skewed kind of worldview, and it can affect the way that a police officer approaches his job. You know, if you're constantly told that every interaction with a citizen could be your last, you're going to start to see every citizen as a threat. Mm-hmm. And so I do think there's something to that. And in fact, I mean, the job of police officer is as safe as it's ever been. Actually, last year was one of the safest years for police officers in, I think, 40 or 50 years. And it's actually, I mean, you're actually more likely to be killed just living in a city like Los Angeles or Chicago than you are to be killed while working as a police officer. Now, that's not to say, you know, there are some cops who have, you know, very dangerous beats. There are some cops who, you know, do very dangerous work. And it's not to, you know, belittle them or you know, talk down the threat that they actually do face at all. But, you know, I do think we need to stop sort of constantly telling police officers how dangerous their jobs are, because I do think it affects how they view the public.
When politicians talk about putting more federal money into putting more cops on the street in the United States, are they really talking about giving more weapons, or are they talking about hiring more officers to walk the beats? And can we know the difference when we decide to either support or oppose these proposals?
Yeah, these are, I mean, these are really important questions and distinctions. Community policing, I interviewed a lot of former police chiefs for my book, and, you know, almost unanimously, they endorse community policing as a great deterrent to crime. And community policing is this idea that cops do walk beats, and they know the names of, you know, the principals of the schools on their beat, and they know the business owners, and they, you know, they go to neighborhood meetings, and they have a stake in the communities, you know, that they're serving, and they're considered a part of that community. The problem, though, is when you start giving these federal grants to police departments, you know, there's no oversight, there's no restrictions on how the money gets spent. And so, in fact, the COPS program, the community policing program, that was started in the 90s during the Clinton administration, you know, had this vision of hiring all these cops to walk beats and to foster this sort of kind of Peace Corps, you might call it, community policing. Problem is, a lot of police chiefs and sheriffs see SWAT teams and sort of reactionary policing as a form of community policing. So this money, this grant, you know, these grants were being sent to these police departments who were then using it to start SWAT teams as, you know, their version of community policing. So these federal grants, you have to, you know, be very careful about how they're given out and put, you know, restrictions on how they're spent, because they don't always go, you know, toward the types of policing philosophies that they're intended to support.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Let's speak with Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. Well, the upshot of what I want to say is that this phenomenon has been increasing because it sells with the public. For the last 30-plus years, we have been involved in what I would refer to as a societally induced paranoia about drug abuse. We are in a, quote, war on drugs, unquote. And how are you going to fight a war without armored personnel carriers, tank-like vehicles, and black-clad, ninja-suited police officers carrying semi-automatic weapons? That said, I think one thing that's been overlooked in the discussion so far is seems to me that this whole phenomenon is an outgrowth of a phenomenon in that started in the middle 70s, which was a fear of urban terrorists, urban revolutionaries. We had the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Yeah, can you talk to that, Bradley?
Well, I would say, let me see how to think about how to respond to that. I think that it's right that, I mean, we've had a generation or a couple generations, I guess, now of constant kind of pandering to fears about crime. And, you know, it absolutely does have an effect. I mean, if you take a police officer and you arm him with military gear, you train him in military tactics, you know, you put him in a military-style uniform, which a lot of departments are switching to, and then you send him out and tell him he's fighting a war, I mean, that is going to have an effect on an officer's mindset and how he approaches his job and how he sees, you know, the community that he's supposed to be serving. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. And again, this goes back to, I say in the book that, I mean, this is a criticism of politicians really more than police officers. I mean, the politicians are the ones who have been declaring war on things and who have, you know, really set these policies that have gotten us to where we are now.
Let's take one final call. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak this time with Will in Fort Worth. Hi, Will.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask about your thoughts on if you came across at all the drug wars that are kind of spilling over into southern Texas from Mexico, and what you think the future of police militarization what maybe is going to happen with that in regards to the drug war?
I haven't done a lot of reporting or research on the border situation. I tend to be suspicious when we hear reports of, you know, new threats to public safety that require lots of, you know, spending and militarizing of various police forces. But, you know, I can't say for sure that the stories about the Mexican drug war spilling over are not true, because I just haven't done a lot of reporting on that. I will say, though, that, you know, a city like El Paso, which is, you know, right across the river from one of the most violent cities in the world, is one of the safest. It's usually the first or second safest big city in the U.S. I mean, the murder rate in El Paso is single digits a lot of years. I mean, it's ridiculously low, actually. So, you know, we haven't seen it there, but, you know, that doesn't mean it isn't happening elsewhere. The second part of your question, you know, I am concerned about this, you know, militarizing the border, and the immigration bill now calls for a lot of, you know, beefing up of border security. And that's going to, you know, that's going to definitely have an effect on this particular issue. And, you know, it also has a broader Fourth Amendment implications also. I mean, there's like a border within the border of the U.S. If you're within 100 miles of the border, you know, that you can be stopped and searched just on suspicion that you may be bringing something into the country. There are these checkpoints that are set up all over the place. So the ACLU calls it the Fourth Amendment free zone. And so I think if we, you know, the more we hear talk about beefing up the border and border security, I think the more we're going to see those types of policies.
Are funding cuts the only way to change this trajectory? Because it seems to me that if your big city, you know, if the big city next to you doesn't decide to pull back on its use of SWAT teams, your city's not going to do that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think funding, cutting these federal programs out completely actually would definitely help. But I think there has to be a public demand for reining in the use of SWAT teams. I think, you know, people have to get upset and start, you know, pressuring politicians to change the policy and say, you know, it's inappropriate to use SWAT teams to raid poker games. We don't want that to happen anymore. And I will say, I mean, I've been covering this issue for about 8 years now, and I do kind of sense a change in the way the public looks at this issue. I'm talking in the book about a drug raid video in Missouri that went viral a couple years ago, and it was a very standard, you know, drug raid, but it was very violent. They shot the dogs, and there was a kid in the house that, you know, was terrified, and they found a tiny, you know, a tiny amount of pot, which pot was actually decriminalized in Columbia, Missouri, so they couldn't even charge him for it. But when the video went online and went viral, I mean, people reacted viscerally. I mean, the police department had its email and phone lines had to be shut down, so they were overwhelmed. It was almost as if, you know, a new generation was sort of seeing how the drug war was actually fought on the ground for the first time, and they were outraged by what they saw. And I found that encouraging.
Radley Balko is an investigative reporter and senior writer for The Huffington Post. His new book is called Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Radley, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones from Christina Martinez, and Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show at kera.org/think. You can also download the podcast. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.